This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Sebastian Truhl, your host for today. And today I'm talking to Jacob Johansen about his just recently published book, Fantasy, Online Misogyny, and the Manosphere, Male Bodies of Disinhibition. And just as a means of introduction, Jacob is senior lecturer in communications at St. Mary's University in London. He's author of Psychoanalysis and Digital Culture, Audiences, Social Media, and Big Data, which was published by Routledge in 2019, and of the forthcoming Event Horizon, Sexuality, Politics, Online Culture, and the Limits of Capitalism, which will be coming out in 2022 on, I think, Zero Books, right? Yeah,
yes.
I think so.
Yes.
Yeah. Jacob's research interests include psychoanalysis and digital media, sexuality in digital media, and psychosocial studies. He's co-editor of the Counterspace section of the journal Psychoanalysis, Culture and Society, and a founder scholar of the British Psychoanalytic Council. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jacob.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very excited to talk to you about this book. It's been a fascinating read for me. And, you know, usually we start off these conversations by asking about your motivation in writing this book. But I think with your particular volume and subject, I think it might be necessary to kind of pose a double question. What interested you in the subject, and what is the manosphere?
Yeah. So I'll explain a little bit what the sort of subject matter of the book is first. So in principle, the book is a kind of psychoanalysis of the manosphere. So the manosphere is a term that describes or kind of summarizes or subsumes a collection or a sort of clustering of communities, websites, spaces, different platforms on the internet. And while they may be quite diverse, they have sort of one thing in common, or they have a couple of things in common. The first thing that they have in common is that they are sort of designated spaces for men. They are kind of reserved spaces and websites and so on that are sort of operated by men. And they are for men. So anyone who, in most cases, wouldn't sort of identify as male or wouldn't call themselves male, wouldn't sort of be allowed to be part of those communities and groups. The manosphere, secondly, is also what characterizes many of those different communities, not all, but many, is that they are specifically anti-feminist, they are sexist, and very often they are highly misogynist as well. They also kind of show a sort of violence within those communities as well. And in the book, I sort of, in the different chapters of the book, I kind of psychoanalyze in a way, or kind of write about different communities of the manosphere. And we might sort of get into them as we go along. But that as a sort of introduction, that's what the manosphere is about. It's a kind of loose clustering of communities, websites, spaces that have some things in common, but at the same time, they're also quite diverse and quite distinct from each other as well. What motivated me to write this book is that, it's a good question, when I started kind of looking into some particular communities of the manosphere, it'd be impossible, I think, to write a book about the sort of manosphere as a whole. That's just impossible. So I look at exemplary kind of communities. I was really struck by the sort of level of misogyny, the level of sexism, the symbolic violence that also in some cases kind of leads to actual real violence outside of the internet. And that was something I hadn't really encountered before, sort of on that level. And at the same time, I also relatively quickly kind of discovered or felt that those men and those communities also, they are more than sort of just, you know, a bunch of misogynists. And I wanted to challenge maybe a little bit. There's lots of research on misogyny. There's lots of research on online misogyny. There is research on the manosphere or on incels or some of those kind of specific communities. And they are very often only looked at in terms of misogyny, or they are kind of discussed from a very critical angle. And I very much agree with that. But I think there's more to that. There's more to those communities. There's more to those men. So I wanted to challenge that maybe a little bit as well, that there is sometimes a bit of a sort of one-sidedness to these arguments, where they are being dismissed as mere kind of misogynists. And if we apply a kind of psychoanalytic lens, things start to get messy, things start to get more complex, I think. Those were some of my motivations for this book.
Right. You just mentioned the psychoanalytic perspective you have on the subject you're looking at, and from what I gathered in the book, like one of the main protagonists or people thinkers you use is Klaus Thiewelyte, a German thinker who did this massive study on soldier men in the Weimar Republic in Germany, right? You could call them a proto or pre-fascist men who sort of laid the foundation for statewide fascism in Germany, and it's I think it's a very interesting connection you're making, because at first glance, you know, what could these two groups of men have in common, right? I mean, fascist men in Weimar Germany and users of this online space, the manosphere. How would you describe the connection or the use you make of Thiewelyte for your project?
Mm-hmm. That's Thiewelyte, his kind of his work, Male Fantasies, his kind of two volume work, Male Fantasies, is, of course, it's very kind of specific, it's very historical in a way. And as you say, how can we sort of connect him or connect his ideas to kind of contemporary masculinity, to contemporary misogyny, and so on. At the same time, and I think he would probably acknowledge that, what he sort of writes about is also kind of universal. He sort of writes about a particular embodied form of misogyny and of course then links to fascism and so on, that is out there because of patriarchy and because of sort of universal misogyny that exists in, you know, probably most societies in the world. And what when I was sort of starting to research for this book and sort of reading work around fascism and so on, it seemed to me that Tavelight's work is sort of the best book on kind of trying to understand or sort of providing an analysis of fascism, all those sort of forces and sort of embodied mechanisms that eventually lead to fascism. That is that there's this sort of unparalleled what he has achieved. And I mean it's very difficult to summarize his work. It's sort of more than 1,000 pages long if you combine the two books. I try to do that a little bit in the first chapter of the book, and I can sort of try and do that a little bit now. It's even harder to do it in a few minutes. But one of the sort of key insights, I think, from Tavelight's work and how he, as you said, he kind of analyzed the Freikorps soldiers, sort of proto-fascist militia men, essentially, that were sort of roaming Germany of the 1920s and engaging in absolutely brutal, horrific acts of killing. That would sort of form the blueprint for later acts of killing undertaken by the Nazis and so on in the Third Reich. But what the point that one of the points that Tavelight makes is that he looks at those narratives of those men themselves through analyzing things like diary entries, also analyzing fiction at the time and later fiction where that sort of romanticized or kind of idealized or glamorized these Freikorps soldiers and those men. So he kind of looks at their own voices almost, or at their own narratives. That's something I very much wanted to do as well. And the point that he makes is that the men that he analyzes, they were all on some level kind of defending against what he kind of sort of calls sort of a fear of bodily disintegration and a fear of becoming psychotic. That they've very much felt sort of threatened by women in particular. And this has complex sort of reasons that we sort of can't get into now, probably is to do with, you know, Germany lost the First World War. Those men were sort of defeated, or their sort of fathers were defeated, etc., etc. It's to do with how they were raised as boys and things like that. They have a fear of everything that we could sort of call, you know, feminine, of everything that is sort of sensual and of everything that is sexual specifically as well. And they kind of defend against all those fears, all those anxieties by killing others, by killing, you know, enemies, communists, socialists, women as well. And of course, that's not, you know, that's not the same what those men do that are described in the book, but they also, in a way, I sort of make the argument that, you know, in different ways, they also feel that their kind of sense of masculinity and that their egos are also kind of fragmented, and that they are sort of threatened, constantly threatened with kind of disintegration or feelings of being kind of undone, feelings of being destroyed. And that's also kind of similar to Thevelite soldiers, that's also women. So women are responsible for that. Feminism is responsible for that in some way. So those are parallels between, you know, between those. And that both of those men, types of men, they seek refuge in a sort of collectivity. In Thevelite's case, it's kind of fascism of what is going to be fascism. And in the case of sort of the men of my book, it's the Manosphere. It's specific, very, very specific communities that they then sort of become part of, and specific identities that they take up, where they then sort of feel part of a collective that literally kind of holds them together, holds their ego kind of together.
Right, right. And to get into your material, the data you were looking at, you start off your analysis by looking at this group of men who refer to themselves as so-called incels, right? Involuntary celibate men. So men who feel like they involuntarily do not get to have sex, right? I mean, that's pretty much the definition of themselves. And so how, what did you find in the material? How did the sort of the Thevelitean framework apply to the material you were looking at? What were they talking about?
Mm-hmm. With incels, that's sort of, yeah, it's a particular kind of community of the Manosphere. And what they were, they sort of talk about lots and lots of things. I couldn't cover sort of everything that they, you know, the sort of wealth of the material, of the kind of things that they talk about. I'm only sort of offering a kind of snapshot of that in the book. But one sort of starting point maybe for understanding incels, and that makes them very unique as a community of the Manosphere, is how hopeless they feel kind of about the world and about their own kind of destiny. So because they have never been, in most cases never, maybe in some cases not for a long time, been in a relationship with a woman, they feel that, you know, this that has sort of, they're destined for this life, for this celibacy, for this life of being alone and you know, being an incel. So it's a very, very deterministic worldview that they articulate.
And at the same time, if I may jump in real quick, it's a very distinct identity they're creating with this, right? I mean, this idea of being an incel seems to be something that's obsessively repeated over and over again in the material you cite, right?
Yeah. And this is something, actually, I think that is sort of the case for all of those men that, and perhaps that's also the case in kind of fascist movements, but probably not to that extent, that those different communities I look at, they constantly need to reassure themselves of kind of who they are and what they are. And this is, in a sense, a kind of exist. They're in a sort of constant existential crisis in a way, where it's sort of about, who am I? What does it mean, you know, in this case, to be an incel? And that's something they sort of discuss and kind of negotiate all the time. Where it's also very often a matter of qualifying themselves, whether somebody is an incel or isn't an incel. And that's a very, at least for me as an outsider, it's sort of quite a vague description in a way, because there are many cases where somebody might join this community and describe themselves, and then someone else says, "Oh, but you are not an incel because." All right. I don't know, you are not depressed enough, or you have contact with women, or you actually have a good job, or something like that. So it's almost a race to the bottom, if you will, that those men engage in, where they constantly need to kind of verify and reassure themselves that they are incels, and thereby kind of they belong to this collective. So that gives them a sense of, maybe that gives them a sense of purpose, that gives them a sense of belonging, that they are part of this incel community, of this male group, and that kind of allows them to bond, maybe that allows them to feel part of a whole, and that then sustains a very, very fragile kind of sense of identity. And in a way, that's similar to how any kind of collective works, but it's certainly also the case in fascism. That's something that Tevelight sort of stresses, that those men he writes about, they are being sustained by either the Freikorps brigade, or then later by fascism kind of proper, where fascism unites them in a kind of collective. And it's something similar, so it's sort of going on within incels. So they have a very bleak outlook on life. They have a very, very sort of destructive, very kind of depressive view about life and about themselves in particular, because they are those unsuccessful, ugly, you know, men. Often they talk about mental health conditions as well. That, you know, and all of this sort of makes them destined to be kind of forever alone. But this is specifically then coupled with misogyny, with the hatred of women, because in their kind of, to them, women and feminism and kind of contemporary society, they're all responsible for, you know, this situation that incels are in, that incels are ignored, that they're rejected. It's because women are, you know, allegedly they're only interested in, you know, good-looking men, what incels call the Chad. The Chad is a kind of, it's a fantasy figure. It's a construction that of a kind of male figure that they construct, who is a sort of muscular, you know, handsome male that all women are, you know, sort of want to be with, or most women want to be with.
With a very distinct jawline, right? That seems to be a very important feature.
Absolutely. So incels are also, and this makes them quite unique, they're obsessed about genetics. They're obsessed about, as you say, the jawline. They talk about sort of their jawlines all the time, or very often, because they say if you don't have a very pronounced or kind of manly jawline, you know, that's the end. You know, that's the end of things.
It's a very mechanistic view of the world in general, but also of relationships, right? Like, I mean, it seems like if only they had the right ingredients or the right features, then everything would be fine. But they just don't, right?
Absolutely.
There's like this distinct sense of victimhood, and I'm just wondering, like, because. You know, you could look at it and saying, like, you know, that they're perpetuating sense of victimhood. But at the same time, like, what I'm wondering about is, and you get into this in the book, using Tevelight, what is it that they're defending against by doing that?
Yeah. So on one level, it is about cultivating, constructing victimhood. So they are clearly the victims of superficial women, etc., etc. But then at the same time, they sort of seek to move beyond that. And this move, I think, is one that entirely, or in most cases, entirely occurs or takes place in their minds, in fantasies that they then articulate online, that they write about online, etc. Where, for example, through this figure of the Chad, you know, there is a sort of love-hate relationship to the Chad. So in a way, we could also see, you know, this figure of the Chad as a male body that incels, you know, sort of eroticize perhaps, or that they desire, because, you know, at the end of the day, they want to be the Chad. They want to, you know, they want to have that body. And that's something they talk about quite a lot as well, And they really debate this, whether, for example, they should be undergoing things like cosmetic surgery, or whether they should be going to the gym or things like that. And some say, no, you know, this, you're giving in to, you know, you're giving in to the Stacey, you know, what they call the Stacey, the kind of stereotypical female, you're giving in to those demands, you know, you should not follow that. You should, you know, this should never happen. And others say, you know, that's my only hope. That's my only kind of hope that I have left. I'll go to the gym, or I'll work out, or I'll change my appearance, or I'll have cosmetic surgery to change my body. And as I was sort of looking, this is a very visual community as well, like most of the internet today. I'm not sure if I want to encourage listeners to, you know, venture into those communities and look at the data. But incels and other men, they share lots of images, they share lots of memes, lots of clips, etc., where they create visualizations or images of the chat and of female bodies, etc. And what really struck me, and sort of to go back to Tevolite a little bit, is that the chant, how this, you know, the chant is kind of constructed as a fantasy. I read that as a fascist body. You know, I see how the chant's body is kind of created by those men. That's the body of the fascist soldier. That's the body of the soldier male that Tevolite writes about. That's the body of the soldier in fascist societies, where, you know, men or the soldier becomes the kind of archetypical, idealized body in society that everyone should emulate. And it's a body that's muscular, that's strong, that's kind of, you know, it's like it's made of steel, etc. And that's what incels essentially, you know, they want to become a sort of fascist body, is my argument. And that is not a coincidence that this fantasy emerges, you know, at this moment, or that it's been sort of circulating for a couple of years now. It's because we see a very existential or a very real threat of fascism or of kind of right-wing populism emerging everywhere in the world. And you know, post-Trump or kind of, you know, Trump presidency, etc. And there is lots of overlap between incels and kind of fascist movements online, such as the alt-right movement, for example, that is a sort of fascist, sort of neo-fascist movement on the internet.
Something that really struck me in the book, and this is very confusing to me, maybe you can say something about that, is the sense that all these communities, like not just incels, but also you also analyze this group of men who call themselves men go in their own way, right? Who sort of like one step beyond incels almost, like they've kind of renounced women altogether. What seems very striking, like, is the creation of this narrative of victimhood. And at the same time, there seems to be a very strong element of defending against every sense of passivity or softness, or sort of like it's very odd, because at on one level there is helplessness, right, and they talk about that all the time, and on the other hand there seems to be a real threat emanating in their view from everything that's kind of that would make them vulnerable to a real interaction with a woman, right? To actually, you know, try to get in touch with someone and actually talk to them and, you know, be rejected, but then trying again. And that's something that they really like, that they shy away from, but there seems to be like a powerful wish to give in to a sort of like passivity at the same time. And it's very confusing to read those accounts.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think this contradiction is really at the heart of those communities in different ways. And I think if we look at it psychoanalytically, it's probably not a contradiction, because, you know, very often, you know, that's sort of psychoanalysis is all about those contradictions, perhaps, or that there is hate, there is love, and things like that. And I think that's also the case with those men. On one level, they absolutely defend against those feelings of vulnerability, of, we could also maybe call them sort of feminine elements of themselves. They defend against those, but then at the same time, I agree that they they want nothing more than to perhaps even break out of those communities, or perhaps to make a step into some sort of direction of opening up to women, of having more interactions with women, etc. And I think we can also see that in the fact, and at first I was sort of puzzled by this. So particularly this is the case in this community, men going their own way, or MGTOW, which is sort of different from incels, because it's a community of where men are sort of saying, we no longer, we don't need to be with women, we don't want to be with women, women are not needed in our lives. We have a sort of male supremacist community, or we live a sort of male lifestyle where we're just surrounded by men. But then if you look at that community, they talk about that a lot, and they say kind of how happy they are, or what they've been doing, and kind of talk about their lives and things like that. But then at the same time, that community is full of posts about women. So they need to talk about women all the time. They can't stop. And it's the same with incels. It's the same with, lots of these communities. So perhaps, somebody who isn't so psychoanalytically inclined would probably say, how does that go together? Why do they do that, all of these men, if they kind of hate women so much? And I unpack this a little bit in the book through psychoanalytic work on racism, psychoanalytic work on fascism, where various scholars have sort of made the argument that even though it seems like that fascism, for example, or racism is all about destroying the other, it's about literally often killing the other person, the person that is othered. Underneath that is a kind of principle fantasy that the other needs to be maintained. The other needs to be there. Otherwise, that whole kind of fantasy construction, it collapses like a house of cards, because in a way, the more the kind of fascist, the more the racist, or the more the misogynist tries to symbolically or actually kind of annihilate or destroy the other, the stronger that other kind of gains a presence in fantasy, and the more this other is needed actually to sustain this whole sort of identity, because for those men, their identities in some way revolve around questions of femininity, they revolve around women, etc. So for that reason, this fantasy of what women are, how women are like, how they behave, needs to be maintained. And perhaps this is also a sort of, they may be sort of unconsciously in doing that, they are sort of keeping a back door open, perhaps for themselves, where, they can actually sort of get out of that community or those communities in some way, even though that's something they don't want. But this contradiction of desiring the other and kind of wanting to destroy the other is sort of maintained in that way, in that sort of double bind in a way. Yeah,
I think you bring up a very important point in the chapter on this online phenomenon. I think it's almost the nofap community, right? This anti porn movement, sort of like this. It's this movement against the consumption of pornography. And I think what's very interesting to me is your discussion of their reflection or of talking about these very specific porn genres of cuckold porn and of this what's it, sissy porn,
I think. Sissy is called a sissy hypnosis porn, or called sissy hypno porn, they call it. Yeah.
Right, and maybe we can talk a bit about those specific like subgenres of pornography, but what was really interesting to me, to follow up on a point you made earlier, is this idea that there's a key element of their discussions is sort of the fear of their own homosexuality, I guess, or possible latent homosexuality, but you actually take that a bit further and say there's. They talk about their fear of being gay as sort of a naming of something that's even more ungraspable, and that would be the unconscious, right? Like the unconscious with all its polymorphous perversity, its uncontrollable drives, and you know, you name it by saying, "Oh shit, they're trying to turn me gay" or whatever. But actually, there's this thing within them that they're trying to fight or defend against because it seems so overwhelming, right?
That's something that I was kind of really, really sort of thinking about as I was looking into that community. So NoFap is an anti-porn, anti-masturbation community specifically as well, and it's far more sort of nuanced than those other communities that I look at. Some people might say that it actually doesn't belong to the manosphere. I disagree with that. I think it's part of the manosphere as well, because it's all about sort of questions of cis masculinity and things like that. And there's lots of toxic elements within that as well. But what those men I think reveal are what is the role of the unconscious here? Because that's something I was really kind of thinking about as I was writing the book, and that's also a point that sort of Tevelak makes in his work, is that those men he kind of writes about, they were all sort of very, very consciously, trying to stop those sort of feelings of bodily disintegration, trying to stop feelings of kind of becoming overwhelmed, of becoming psychotic. They were sort of trying to stop those through whatever acts that they committed, violence that they committed. And I had a similar sort of question when I was writing about kind of communities like the incel community and so on. All of those communities are very, very, everything is there. Everything is sort of out in the open. Nothing is symbolic. There is no, I mean, on one level, those communities are very, very kind of symbolic, and it's all about symbolism. They construct their own language. They construct their own codes. It's very cryptic. I've got the sort of glossary in the book, so for readers who don't know what these terms mean, I kind of try to define them. So it's all about kind of symbols on one level, but at the same time, everything is there. Those men are very, very, they're very articulate. They're very reflexive. They're constantly kind of reflecting about themselves, about who they are, about their identities, about their mental health, things like that. So on one level, I kept sort of thinking, where is the unconscious here? You know, the psychoanalysis, that's the kind of key question. Or what is it that I'm not seeing in the data, where I can, from a sort of, if this was a sort of, if I was a clinician, or if this was a more clinical context, you would almost, kind of read through the lines. If those were kind of free associations, you would look for things where, maybe sort of unconscious dimensions reveal themselves.
Right, and it seems like you'd ask, what are they repressing, right? And it seems they're not repressing
nothing. Nothing. It seems nothing. And of course, I mean, that can't be. I mean, but then that's what I was left with until I looked, or until I sort of got to NoFap. And NoFap is perhaps sort of unique in that sense, as it, I think tells us more about those questions where, as you say, those men, they talk about their kind of porn consumption, or they frame it as porn addiction. So they are sort of, they say that they're addicted to the consumption of pornography, and that has weakened them, that has weakened their sort of sense of masculinity, their sense of cis or heterosexual masculinity is weakened because of that. And very well, that's how they feel. You know, I think one should take that seriously. But then at the same time, what is kind of problematic about those, about that community perhaps, is that they then talk about different types of pornography that they consume. And you mentioned two kind of sort of sub-genres that they talk about that are kind of, I think, fairly niche within porn, but they seem to be growing as well. I wasn't really aware of them until I started analyzing the NOFAP data. And those two genres are, one is what this sissy hypnoporn that's sort of about, that depicts scenes or sort of where men or where the male viewer is hypnotized and into being a woman, or into sort of hypnotized into becoming more emasculated. That should be sexually arousing. That's the point of that genre. And the other cuckold genre, cuck porn, is about a scene where somebody is forced to kind of watch their sort of wife being unfaithful, essentially. I mean, I'm very simplifying things here, but right. This is something that they talk about, that for them, that those that present particular extreme forms of porn that they want to, that they kind of need, that as their kind of addiction sort of escalated more and more and more. And then coming back to the unconscious, they very much then sort of speculate sort of what's behind that, or who is behind that. So they...
Right, there's these big conspiracy theories
into this conspiracy logic where they kind of say, oh, feminists are behind that. LGBTQ plus communities or individuals are behind that. There is a conspiracy behind that to weaken us, you know, men, us kind of traditionally cis men, and our kind of male culture is all being weakened because kind of feminists are behind, or somebody is behind that they want to take over. This kind of speculation, I think, is actually a desire to defend against their own unconscious, to defend against, you know, polymorphous perversity of the unconscious, or what we could also kind of call the, you know, kind of quintessential, you know, kind of queer nature of sexuality that, right, you know, Freud, right, already kind of mentions. So they want to defend against that in kind of more sort of Deleuzian terms, in Deleuzian Guattarian terms. They want to defend against the sort of productivity of their unconscious by then continuously speculating, but they never find an answer, obviously, or they're never satisfied with an answer in a way, because of course, because nobody, you know, because there is nobody behind this, so there is no conspiracy kind of behind this, and instead, it's actually the question is, you know, have they had those sort of, you know, desires, or have they had this, you know, what we could call sort of queer sexuality all along, or has it been maybe brought out because of, you know, their sort of pornography consumption? Of course, that's a question nobody can answer, but it's a question that I think gives them such fundamental anxiety because they can't understand those unconscious processes because they are unconscious. So a scapegoat needs to be found.
Right. It's very interesting how you start off the chapter on the NoFap community by talking about the increasing or the high number of possibilities of identification that we now have when watching pornography, right? That we can imagine or identify with so many different positions within people having sexual intercourse. There's like this sense of passivity that is almost always like graspable, and that's like deeply unsettling for quite a number of people, actually. Coming in touch with that sense of or with those latent wishes, probably, right? And then there's the reaction to it. There's no fap. There's men go in their own way. There's these reactions to a heightened sense of possibility, all these things you can do post so-called sexual revolution.
Absolutely. Yeah. Go on.
Please. No, please go ahead.
I think that is also something that they... this sort of idea of passivity is something that they also talk a lot about, because to them that's another it's another failure, that they are actually watching sexual intercourse taking place in a video or whatever on screen. For them that's the ultimate failure, because they could be they should be that man that they're watching. They should be there in his place. And instead, they are passive and etc. And that is a sort of sense of failure, because it's tied to kind of questions of masculinity, and for them, sort of successful masculinity in neoliberal times is about there is no need for masturbation, for example, because you are in a relationship with a woman, so you are getting sexual pleasure, etc., from somebody else, and that's what masculinity is about. And it's not about those sort of dynamics that they seem to be kind of caught up in.
This idea of masculinity you just mentioned, or more generally speaking of like this manliness, is something that also runs like a thread through these communities, right? And I think you make a very interesting point about it being connected to these ideas of the father. In all the communities we already discussed, but also in manifestos of mass shooters you look at, which is probably the more disturbing part of the book. But in that chapter specifically, looking at, for example, Breivik's relationship to his father, right, or his ideas about his father, and another shooter, I forget his name,
Elliot Roger, yeah, called himself an incel, actually, yeah,
right. Mm. And there's this strong sense of not having gotten the right phallic sort of masculinity from the father, right? But then also like there are these ideas of allying with sort of this tyrannical almost like brutal father in sort of exercising any feminine part in the self, right? There's this very strong idea of clinging to father to get rid of vulnerability, and by actually by performing, this man crossed the boundary and actually performed these awful acts, right?
So that's something I sort of also unpack a little bit through the psychoanalyst, late psychoanalyst Ruth Stein, who's written a, I think, really, really important book about Islamist terrorists, and which is a sort of she sort of provides a sort of psycholytic understanding or kind of analysis of them, and she also kind of makes this link to the father that, of course, in any religion, or not in many religions, certainly not in any, God is often portrayed or is actually a father figure and is the sort of ultimate father, and Stein sort of makes the argument that's certainly the case for those Islamist terrorists, where they are essentially guided in their violence by a father figure that is God, and it's about then sort of gaining or kind of finally gaining some sort of sense of power, perhaps, or recognition. And those two mass shooters that I look at in one chapter of the book, Breivik, the cases, of course, that case is quite well known, and Elliot Rodger, who is often sort of also talked about in the manosphere, who committed acts of shooting in 2014 in the United States, and who was also sort of called himself an incel. Both of them had sort of particular failed relationship maybe to the father, and that made me want to sort of look into that a little bit more. And in psychoanalytic theory often in psychoanalysis, it's the father that is the kind of, that is the intervening agent, that is the third that kind of, breaks this sort of dyad between mother and baby, that opens up the, the baby towards, a sort of sense of reality, almost. In Lacan, of course, that then becomes, it becomes sort of name of the father, symbolic order, things like that. It's all sort of connected. So there is, on some level, the father is quite important in psychoanalysis. And it's then maybe also kind of important in sort of what I kind of call handing down the phallus. Or that's
right.
An argument that, Jessica Benjamin makes, for example, that the father is idealized by the boy in particular. Those men, particularly those two, they had kind of a sort of failed relationship or problematic relationship with their fathers, where they didn't feel valued, or they weren't seen by their fathers, so that they had to commit these ultimate acts of horror, essentially, in perhaps an unconscious sort of hope of finally being seen, and ultimately, of course, in doing that, they want to sort of go beyond their own fathers. They want to kind of surpass their fathers, or want to kind of kill the father as well, in that sense. And that's also something that is sort of mirrored a little bit in the other communities that I look at, incels, for example, in particular, because they also talk a lot about their parents and their fathers in particular, them being men, that they are in the situation they're in because of their parents. So they blame their parents for sort of having the wrong gene pool, or having the wrong sort of genetic base that they then passed on to incels, or passed on to those men. To some degree, they are in this sort of position because of their parents, or because of their fathers in particular. And that's also the case with Breivik or Rodger as well.
Right. You described the book before as a psychoanalysis of the manosphere, right? And I think that's actually a very good description, because it feels like what you're trying to do is to open up a space to think, especially in the face of these very mechanistic worldviews, right? Of these ideas of you know, like the genetic determinism, for example, that these men talk about. And you actually you try to sort of open up a space, and it's very interesting that the last chapter in the book, or the conclusion, is titled "Space for Hope," and in the end you sort of talk about a possible vision out of the man of the dead end of the manosphere, right? By using Jessica Benjamin again, Jessica Benjamin's recognition theory. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yes. So as I was sort of writing this book and sort of having conversations with colleagues and particularly with Caroline Bainbridge and Candida Yates, who are the series editors of the book series that this book is part of, Psychoanalysis and Popular Culture. The question, sort of the sort of a major kind of question, kind of presented itself in a way, and that's about, is there a way out, or you know, what follows from this? What are we to do? What are we left with? At the end of the day, and that's a very difficult question. I think that's a question that's is almost impossible to answer. Or also in terms of how can we intervene in those communities is very difficult. It's almost impossible, I think. And in a way, those probably a lot of those men, they actually need individual. You know, it certainly wouldn't do them any harm if they were in therapy or in psychodynamic therapy. You know, let's put it this way. That's probably what they would need. But the other sort of question was, you know, is there perhaps a bit of hope in this, or is there perhaps a bit of a different perspective in this? And with my kind of theoretical framework that I use in the book, that's probably quite difficult to deliver or to kind of show, because I look at things like the phallus. I draw on Thévelite. I talk about questions of inhibition, etc., etc. So that isn't really possible through my sort of quite Freudian framework in a way. But then I was sort of reading Benjamin. And her, you know, her work on recognition, that opened up a different perspective for me, really. So Benjamin, kind of very briefly, listeners will probably know this. For Benjamin and her sort of relational approach, recognition is the sort of foundational moment between, the subject or the baby and the caregiver. You know, in most cases the mother, but then also sort of other primary caregivers around the baby. So recognition for her then means that the baby is able to, and the subject eventually is able to see that the other is similar and also different from, you know, from myself, and the other is able to do the same. So the other is also able to see that they are the same as the subject, and they're different from the subject as well. And this is kind of foundational for Benjamin. It's foundational for any ethics and things like that. And that's really how she has kind of developed psychoanalysis and through her sort of emphasis on the third and things like that. But I was really struck by a particular idea that she kind of talks about that sort of very much comes from Winnicott, where for Winnicott and kind of object relations approaches, if we look at instances of fantasies of destruction, and you know the book is full of those. The book is full of fantasies of destruction, very violent fantasies of, you know, revenge, annihilating the other, destroying the other, etc. But from a kind of, you know, Winnicott talks about that, you know, the infant also has these fantasies, and they are actually very foundational. They're very existential for the infant, in so far as they, you know, sort of have fantasies of destroying the other in their mind, and of, you know, kind of destroying the other. And in order to see if the other will survive those fantasies, and if, you know, if the other survives those fantasies, they are really there. They really exist, and they can give me that recognition. They can give me that love. They really, you know, they really love me, and this is very important for any, you know, for any relationship and so on, because it means that, you know, conflict, etc., can take place, and there is enough sort of unconditional love that sustains all of that. And that's something that I was then sort of, so I think that's maybe also the case with those men, because at the end of the day, what those men want, and we've talked about this earlier, you know, they, in a way, all they want is recognition. They want to be seen, they want to be recognized, they want to be valued, they want to be loved by the other, by women. The tragedy perhaps is that they can't articulate that. Sometimes they do, but very often they don't. And instead, they continuously create those fantasies that are, at the end of the day, perhaps, you know, similar to what Winnicott talks about. So that those fantasies of destruction are actually perhaps unconsciously about testing, you know, checking if the other will survive them. That's also why this other, you know, the woman has to be continuously talked about in those communities, so that this presence is there, that the presence is sort of maintained. Of course, the difference perhaps here is that there is no actual other there. You know, that's the problem. Whereas, you know, in the infant mother relationship, or in sort of early years relationships, there is actually a person there who can, you know, signal to the child, or who can signal to, who can show, I'm here, I'm surviving your sort of phantasmatic attacks on me. And that's not there.
It's very interesting. I just thought, if the book itself isn't that kind of gesture as well. You know, that because you're actually trying to think about these men, right? You're not giving in to the impulse of, and this is something you talk about throughout the book, of not platforming these people, right? I mean, you actually make a point at different stages of the book saying, you know, I think it's actually really important to look at the data, to think about what they're saying, to think about the meaning of what they're saying. And it's very different than saying, you know, obviously these men are saying horrible things, we shouldn't even engage with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is maybe also, this is the sort of tension I was in, or that's a kind of tension I sort of have to live with, or that I have to maintain, or that I sort of manage in the book on one level. This is a kind of critical analysis of those men, and I very critically I sort of unmask them, perhaps. But then at the same time, it is also about that, as you say. And I there are, of course, limits to that understanding. And I'm a man, so I can probably understand them differently than, you know, a woman could. I wouldn't necessarily expect a woman to, you know, or to you know, we wouldn't necessarily demand of a woman to understand them in that way, because they are the target here. So that's something I think that's something important to sort of keep in mind. But at the same time, I also don't think it's sort of helpful to just ban them. I mean, so, some of those communities also that I was sort of monitoring as I was doing the research, they're already banned now. So that data is actually it's gone. The data is deleted because Reddit, for example, shut lots of those communities down, and that leads to bigger questions in relation to what do we want the internet to look like, etc. But and that's very difficult to answer, because on one level by just shutting these communities down, we gain nothing. It's not like those men then stop. It's not like they would stop calling themselves incels just because their forums is been banned now. But at the same time, should these communities be so publicly accessible? They're very open, and anyone can join them. This is a very, very complex question. But just by only criticizing them, or by only trying to cancel them, or I don't think that's the way forward. It's a complex
question,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Well, Jacob, we're already over the 1 hour mark, so I think we have to bring this to a close. Thank you so much. This conversation was great, and the book is very fascinating, so I'll encourage the audience to pick it up. It's called Fantasy, Online Misogyny, and the Manosphere, Male Bodies of Disinhibition, and I've been talking to Jacob Johansen. Thank you very much, Jacob.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.